Wednesday.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Russia on Monday said more than 60 soldiers were killed in a Ukrainian strike on Russian-controlled territory in a New Year assault, the biggest loss of life reported by Moscow so far. Late on Monday, the General Staff of Ukraine's Armed Forces said in a statement that its forces were behind the strikes.
According to Ukrainian officials, around 400 people were killed during that attack, and also hundreds were wounded. So this is what we hear from Ukrainian officials. However, we know that Russian officials only confirmed the fact of the attack. And according to Russian officials, there are something like 63 people killed.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Mourners have been paying their respects to soccer legend Pelé at a stadium in his hometown of Santos in Brazil. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Fireworks popped as a hearse carrying soccer great Pelé drove towards the Vila Belmiro Stadium, where mourners could come to say their final goodbyes. Pelé died a few days earlier after a battle with cancer. He was 82 years old. Carried into the stadium by his son, among others, Pelé's coffin was placed on the field, where he scored some of the best goals of his career. Pelé's casket will be ushered through the streets of Santos before his burial. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and other dignitaries are expected to attend. I'm Karen Chamas.
Tens of thousands of people paid their respects on Monday to former Pope Benedict XVI of the Vatican at the start of 3 days of lying in state in St. Peter's Basilica before his funeral on Thursday. They began queuing before dawn to view his body, which was transferred early in the morning from the monastery in the Vatican grounds. This is VOA News. Two helicopters collided in an Australian tourist hotspot, killing four people and critically injuring three others. Police said the crash drew emergency aid from beachgoers who had been enjoying the water during the southern summer. Queensland State Police said one helicopter was taking off and the other landing when they collided near the SeaWorld theme park in Main Beach on the Gold Coast. Authorities in the U.S. say waves of migrants have been arriving in southern Florida. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
At least 500 migrants have arrived in small boats along the Florida Keys over the last several days in what one sheriff is calling a crisis. The arrivals are due to economic turmoil, food shortages, and soaring inflation in Cuba and other parts of the Caribbean. Over the weekend, 300 migrants arrived at the sparsely populated Dry Tortugas National Park about 70 miles west of Key West. Officials say 160 migrants arrived by boats in other parts of the Keys over the New Year's Day weekend. Another 30 people and two groups of migrants were found in the Middle Keys on Monday. U.S. Border Patrol and Coast Guard crews patrolling South Florida and the Keys have been experiencing the largest escalation of migrations by boat in nearly a decade. I'm Norman Hall.
The U.S. has returned a looted ancient artifact. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
It's an ancient wooden coffin, a sarcophagus that dates back to the late dynastic period of ancient Egypt, an era that spanned from 664 BC until Alexander the Great's campaign in 332 BC. It may have belonged to an ancient priest. It had been on display at the Houston Museum of Natural Sciences, but 3 months ago, the Manhattan DA's office determined it had been looted from an area north of Cairo and smuggled into the U.S. in 2008, trafficked by a well-organized network that has done this with other antiquities, says the DA. I'm Rita Foley.
The Monday night NFL game between the Buffalo Bills and Cincinnati Bengals was suspended after a player collapsed on the field and received CPR before an ambulance took him away. Partway through the first quarter, Bills player DeMar Hamlin took a hard hit during a tackle, stood up, and then collapsed on the field. He received medical attention for over 20 minutes, with ESPN reporting that he had received CPR. Actor Jeremy Renner, who played Hawkeye in the Marvel Avengers movies, was in critical but stable condition in a Nevada hospital on Monday, a day after suffering a traumatic injury while plowing snow, his publicist and local officials said. Find more on these stories on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukrainian forces kill at least 60 Russian soldiers controlling an eastern city while Russians step up their offensive on Kyiv.
Drones, missiles, and artillery shells launched by Russian forces also struck areas across Ukraine.
A deadly helicopter crash in Australia.
Initial inquiries would appear that one has been taking off and one has been landing.
And dozens of inmates break out of a prison in northern Mexico. We'll have these stories and more next. Ukrainian forces used U.S.-supplied guided rockets to target a building that housed Russian soldiers in an occupied eastern city early on New Year's Day. That's according to both sides. It was one of the deadliest strikes on Moscow's forces in the 10-month-old war. At least 60 soldiers and possibly many more were killed. The attack drew immediate criticism in Russia from the war's supporters, who said that the military was making repeated mistakes, including housing soldiers in big numbers within striking distance of Ukrainian weapons. The Russian Defense Ministry said 63 service members were killed in the strike. Russia on Monday continued its offensive on Ukraine, firing at least 40 drones at Kyiv. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas has more.
Kyiv's mayor confirmed that 40 drones made their way towards the capital overnight, but Ukrainian air defenses confirmed all of them were shot down. Drones, missiles, and artillery shells launched by Russian forces also struck areas across Ukraine. Russian forces also fired at a market in the city of Berislav in the Kherson region, wounding several people. Seven drones were shot down over the southern Mykolaiv region. Several more were intercepted in the southeastern Dnipropetrovsk region, where Ukrainian forces also destroyed a missile, which was targeting energy infrastructure in the area. I'm Karen Chamas.
Some people in China's key cities of Beijing, Shanghai, and Wuhan are braving the cold and a spike in COVID-19 infections to return to regular activity, confident of a boost to the economy as more citizens recover from infections. Olivia Chan of Reuters has that story.
Some people in China's key cities brave the cold and a spike in COVID-19 infections to return to regular life on Monday. In Beijing, people gathered to sled or ice skate on a frozen lake in the city on Sunday, nearly a month after China dropped stringent zero-COVID measures to adopt a strategy of living with the virus. However, a wave of infections has since erupted nationwide. State broadcaster CCTV reported on Monday that frontline medical staff are working around the clock to treat COVID-19 patients. In this hospital in the eastern city of Nanjing, patients have flooded the intensive care unit, with 80% of its patients aged 65 and over, many of them with underlying health conditions. That's according to doctors quoted as saying by CCTV. China's biggest holiday, Lunar New Year, begins on January 21st this year. Many tourist attractions are opening up after shutting last August due to a COVID-19 outbreak. According to Chinese news outlet Caixing on Sunday, citing researchers in the Chinese commercial hub, infections in city of Beijing, Guangzhou, Shanghai and Chongqing are close to ending, but they added infections will peak in other urban areas in the latter half of January. Monday's single new COVID death, flat from the previous day, does not match the experience of other countries after they reopened. The official death toll of just under 5,300 since the pandemic began compares with more than 1 million in the United States. China has said it only counts deaths of COVID patients caused by pneumonia and respiratory failure as being related to COVID. The relatively low death count is also inconsistent with rising demand reported by funeral parlors in several cities. According to British-based health data firm Airfinity, about 9,000 people are probably dying each day from COVID in China. Authorities around the world are imposing or considering curbs on travelers from China. The United States, Britain, France, and India are among those asking for a negative COVID test.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters reporting. Australia says a lack of detailed data from Beijing has prompted a move to mandate COVID testing for travelers arriving from China. With infections in China still soaring, Australia is joining countries like the U.S., Japan, and France in ordering pre-departure virus screenings for anyone coming from China. Phil Mercer has this report from Sydney.
From Thursday, January 5, passengers leaving China will have to undertake a COVID-19 test within 48 hours of travel to Australia and show evidence of a negative result. Officials in Canberra said the measure is in response to the significant wave of infections in China and the potential for emerging viral variants in that country. Australia is following other countries in imposing the restrictions on travellers leaving China. They include India, Malaysia, Spain, the United Kingdom and the United States. The Canberra government has said the arrangements are precautionary and temporary. Federal Health Minister Mark Butler told local media Monday that he was concerned about an absence of comprehensive information about the COVID-19 situation in China, especially the lack of genomic sequencing being shared by authorities in the capital, Beijing. Australia believes that the sharing of information is vital if the emergence of new variants of the virus is to be identified at an early stage. Butler told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Monday that Canberra is in step with other countries.
There's no restriction on travel from China. All we're asking is that there be a COVID test submitted before departure. But this is a modest, balanced measure in line with countries across North America, Europe and Asia. Pretty much all of the countries to which we would usually compare ourselves have done something similar to what we've done, or exactly what we've done, and we're confident will give us that access to information that the World Health Organization has said is currently lacking.
Butler said he wasn't aware of any reaction from China regarding the mandatory testing policy that will come into force on January 5. COVID-19 has previously been a source of friction between Australia and China. In 2020, the former centre-right Prime Minister Scott Morrison demanded an inquiry into the origins of the virus that was first detected in China. The call infuriated the government in Beijing, and bilateral relations rapidly deteriorated. There are also disagreements over China's stance on Taiwan, as it regards it as its own territory, and China's increased military tensions in the South China Sea to assert its power. Australia has also been critical of China's human rights record, including crackdowns on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong and China's abuse of its Uyghur Muslim minority. Restrictions were imposed by China on Australian commodities, including coal, wine and barley. Beijing was accused of economic coercion, while claims of anti-China hysteria were made against Australia. Diplomatic ties appear to be improving since the election in May of a centre-left government in Canberra, with several high-profile meetings of senior government officials. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said in December that while Australia sought stability and cooperation with China, its biggest trading partner, there would also be disagreements. The latest government data has shown about 15,000 COVID-19 infections are being reported each week in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A mid-air helicopter collision happened close to SeaWorld Resort, Australia, on Monday when one helicopter was in the process of landing and the other taking off. Reuters reporter Sarah Charlton has the story.
Two helicopters collided mid-air on Australia's Gold Coast on Monday, leaving at least four people dead. Three others were taken to the hospital in a critical condition. The crash took place close to SeaWorld Resort, Australia. Police said one of the helicopters managed to land safely on a sandbank, but the other crashed. Gary Worrell is Queensland Police Acting Inspector.
Initial inquiries would appear that one has been taking off and one has been landing. At this stage, it's my understanding that with the seven people that are injured are from just one helicopter, and all the others are still injured. But we're obviously further inquiries are being conducted.
The Australian Transport Safety Bureau has launched an investigation into the accident.
That's Reporters reporter Sarah Charlton. Tens of thousands of the faithful lined up at St. Peter's Basilica all day Monday to pay their respects to former Pope Benedict, where he is lying in state. Vatican officials say some 65,000 people waited in long lines to pay their respects. Benedict's body will lie in state until Thursday. He made history as the first pope in 600 years to retire back in 2013. He resigned because he said his health impaired his ability to serve as the head of the Catholic Church. For more on Benedict's papacy, VOA's Vincent McCorry spoke with David Gibson, director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University in New York City. Gibson said the pontiff made an unexpectedly close connection with the people of Africa during his time as pope.
Look, as you said, he came in after 26 years almost of Pope John Paul II, the Polish pope who made Africa a special focus of his pontificate. John Paul II traveled at least once a year to Africa and visited dozens of countries. Pope Benedict was a German cardinal, a theologian, very older and very academic and scholarly. He was not expected to travel much or to connect with the African continent, but he did make two trips to Africa, visited three countries, Benin, Cameroon, and Angola. And he really, he made that connection, I think that personal connection. But there were three particular things, I think, that Benedict did that endeared him and made him an important figure to the continent. One is that he had a great focus on the environment. Benedict was actually known as the Green Pope for his advocacy on environmental issues and things that are really so critical to the continent. He was also known as he was also very outspoken on social justice issues and economic justice. He was known as a conservative, but he was very outspoken, very liberal, even in our context on that. And thirdly, he appointed a lot of Africans as cardinals and bishops and in critical positions in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.
Well, having been the first one in 600 years or more to step aside, did he in some way actually create a precedent for future popes, for the current pope, for instance?
He did, absolutely. Benedict, again, known as a conservative, did one of the most innovative things in centuries by resigning. And he made way, again, he made way for Francis, a pope from Argentina, from Buenos Aires. That has proved to be a prophetic move, shifting the image and balance of power in the church from Europe, which Benedict Joseph Ratzinger represented, to the Southern Hemisphere, Africa, Asia, Latin America. And what the death of Benedict XVI really opens a door for is for Pope Francis to resign and retire at some point, which I fully expect him to do.
That was David Gibson of Fordham University in New York City, author of The Rule of Benedict, Pope Benedict XVI and His Battle with the Modern World. He was speaking with my colleague, Vincent McCorry.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
You're listening to VOA News. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol says the United States and South Korea are engaged in talks that could give Seoul a bigger role in the operation of U.S. nuclear forces. In an interview published Monday in a South Korean newspaper, Yoon said the discussion centered on joint planning and exercises with U.S. nuclear forces, an arrangement that he said would have the same effect as nuclear sharing. U.S. officials have not confirmed any such talks, but in the past have ruled out the idea of nuclear sharing with South Korea. More than 20 inmates escaped from a prison in northern Mexico after gunmen suspected of being members of a drug cartel opened fire on the facility. Authorities say the men arrived outside the Chihuahua State Prison on Monday in armored vehicles and began firing on the guards. 10 were killed along with 4 prisoners during the attack in the border city of Ciudad Juarez. Police say some 24 inmates escaped. The EU says it will launch proceedings to remove parliamentary immunity for 2 members of the European Parliament implicated in a corruption scandal. Parliamentary President Roberta Metsola said she made the move after a request from Belgian police. Her statement did not name the MEPs involved. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden is making a rare pitch for bipartisanship with the Republican leader of the U.S. Senate. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports the president travels to the Midwest this week.
President Biden is making plans to travel the country to promote his efforts to bolster the U.S. economy. With the midterms now behind them and Republican leaders ready to take control of the House this week, the Biden administration is pushing bipartisanship. The president will make a rare joint appearance with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in Kentucky Wednesday, where they'll highlight nearly $1 trillion devoted to infrastructure projects. President Biden will meet with Republican leaders as well as he visits the Kentucky side of the Cincinnati area of Ohio. The president's facing a complicated path ahead, with Republicans now gaining control of the House while the Democrats still lead the Senate. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Analysts who study democratic and authoritarian regimes are taking special note of recent protest movements in Iran, China, and Russia. They caution that the authoritarian regimes in these 3 countries are strong, and a certain set of circumstances must line up for dictators to fall. VOA's Laurel Bowman speaks to Natasha Hall, a senior fellow with the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Larry Diamond of Stanford University.
In Iran, tens of thousands have taken to the streets in protest following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody after she was detained for a problem with her headscarf.
The event really struck a nerve across Iran because I think everyone in Iran could see their daughter, their wife, their sister under the same circumstances.
In China, massive protests have swelled too, as well as calls for leader Xi Jinping to step aside.
They began, of course, in furious reaction against the zero COVID lockdowns that have imprisoned tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of Chinese in their apartments.
The protest movement in Russia has been more muted, experts say, though many thousands came out in 2021 after the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, an opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February also brought out protesters.
There were significant protests that emerged briefly after the invasion of Ukraine, and then again later in towards the end of the summer when Russia announced that it would mobilize a broader draft of people to go fight in Ukraine.
Experts say that protesters in Iran, China, and Russia have won policy concessions from their authoritarian regimes, such as China's recent loosening of COVID-19 restrictions following mass public outcries. But what do protest movements need to overturn authoritarian regimes? We asked our experts. An elite split at the top could weaken Putin, they say.
If they think they have a future after the boss is gone, then maybe they'll decide at some point that they'll seek to ally themselves with potential protesters in the streets. They'll make it clear that that they're not going to stand, you know, against them, and maybe that'll encourage, you know, more people to go out in the streets.
Experts see large strikes across Iran as positive, but note that members of the regime's security sector haven't sided with the protesters.
And then finally, I think that there needs to be some kind of leader of this revolution, some kind of uniting factor to what would occur after this regime would fall. And also to give, I think, elements of the regime a way out.
Our experts say protesters will more likely succeed if they can take advantage of an economic crisis in a country, change their tactics, and dig in, potentially for years. And they add that protesters must be nonviolent and better at technology than the regimes that track them.
There's many, many more people in a country and internationally willing to support a nonviolent movement compared to a violent one.
Even without bringing down regimes, which our experts don't expect, protest movements give hope.
I think the reason for hope is precisely in the message that's been delivered, that these regimes lack broad or secure and comprehensive public support.
And as public support erodes, experts say, so does a regime's legitimacy. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
To all our VOA listeners, you can now find International Edition back on our general website, voanews.com. There you will find other great VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voanews.com and thank you for listening. This has been VOA's International Edition. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our websites for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Carol Van Dam. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply troubled and disappointed that a court in Turkey sentenced Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu to 2 years and 7 months in prison. If upheld upon appeal, the sentence would also prohibit İmamoğlu from holding or running for political office. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a statement, his conviction is inconsistent with respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law. France, Germany, and the European Parliament also denounced İmamoğlu's conviction, as did several human rights organizations. Ekrem İmamoğlu is not only the mayor of Istanbul, he is a prominent member of the opposition political party, the Republican People's Party, and a potential presidential candidate in the 2023 elections in Turkey. İmamoğlu's purported crime was insulting public officials in a speech he gave in 2019. State Department spokesperson Price said the United States remains gravely concerned by the continued judicial harassment of civil society, media, political, and business leaders in Turkey, including through pretrial detention, overly broad claims of support for terrorism, and criminal insult cases. In its most recent human rights report on Turkey, the U.S. State Department noted the judiciary faced several problems that limited judicial independence, including allegations of interference by the executive branch. It also reported that observers raised concerns that the outcome of some trials appeared predetermined, and that there was a lack of respect for the due process and adherence to credible evidentiary thresholds. Among other rights abuses, the report also cited arbitrary arrest and continued detention of tens of thousands of persons, including opposition politicians and former members of parliament, lawyers, journalists, and human rights activists. The people of Turkey, spokesperson Price declared in his statement, deserve the ability to exercise their human rights and fundamental freedoms without fear of retribution. The rights to exercise the freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly, and association is enshrined in Turkey's constitution, its international law obligations, and its OSCE commitments. We urge the government to cease prosecutions under criminal insult laws and to respect the rights and freedoms of all Turkish citizens, including by ensuring an open environment for public debate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.